Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with the Gaia app, available through the App Store or Google Play.
You'll have access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, your first month is only 99 cents. There are multiple plans to choose from, including a three-month plan and an annual plan. Gaia has one-of-a-kind shows like Truth Hunter, Buzzsaw, Cosmic Disclosure, Beyond Belief, Missing Links, Hidden Origins, and Deep Space, Unearthing Nazca, and False Flags.
Gaia is available on your Android or iPhone, Roku, Apple TV, and Amazon Fire TV. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. GAIA.com/expandedperspectives. All one word, GAIA.com/expandedperspectives.
Also, coming out September 1st is a horror movie everyone needs to check out. It's called Temple. It's written by Simon Barrett and directed by Michael Barrett. It's the story of three young Americans who descend upon Tokyo on the pretext of Kate, a religious studies major, wanting to sightsee and study Buddhist temples. With Kate is her boyfriend James and her best friend Chris. The three of them follow a mysterious map that leads them deep into the jungles of Japan, searching for an ancient temple. When spirits entrap them, their adventure quickly becomes a horrific nightmare. If you enjoy horror movies, then you'll love this film. Check out Temple, coming out September 1st, starring Logan Huffman, Brandon Sklenner, and Natalia Warner. Let's start the show.
Hey, what is going on, everybody? And thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, and, of course, as always, my web-footed friend sitting across the table from me, the Philly, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm glad to be here. Yes, it is a tad bit damp around here in the state of Texas. Crazy, rainy, hurricane-type weather.
It's been bad.
Everybody that's south of us, we're okay. We're fine. It's been nothing but rain around here, but I know down in Space City in Houston,
it sounds like that.
It is the woodlands and stuff. It is bad.
Thank you to everybody that's emailed the show, that's messaged the show, sent us private messages, checking on us. Thank y'all all so much. We're doing great. Now we've got some listeners down there, south here, and some some family and friends down in there that. It's not doing so well. I mean, there's a lot of them on the run and on the road and trying to get out of there. And, I mean, y'all noticed, look it up on Houston. Houston's about to wash away. I mean, everything. It's bad. There's been several people lose their lives down there. It's rough.
That's right. Don't drown.
A lot of water.
Don't drown. Turn around.
Oh, here he goes.
That's the slogan, right?
Yeah, that is the slogan. But, yeah, it is, it's strange for us to have this happen to in August.
Mm-hmm.
It just never happens, man.
No, I can't. That's what I was just talking about to my wife. I mean, I was like, I cannot remember this time of August, my yard still being lush and green.
Yeah.
It's just usually dry by this time of the year.
Yeah, dry. It's wild. I mean, everything is so green. It's just, I don't know. And then, of course, you always hear these talks like, oh, it's going to be real, real cold, real wet winter. Like, I hear that every winter. Nobody ever goes, ah, oh, it's going to be a mild winter. Don't worry about it, y'all. Everybody's always talking about winter is coming. Winter is coming. Like, yeah, I get it. When it gets here, I'll be worried. But other than that, I'm like, no, come here in Texas.
Right.
It's going to be cold. It's not going to snow. It's just going to ice. That'll be about it.
That'll be about it. About the same as always, right?
Always, yeah.
What's new in your world, Brad?
Man, oh, man, not much. Playing a little disc golf. Of course, now with the rains, it's going to put the brakes on some more of that. But that's about it. Monkeying around in the house. I think I'm fixed to start remodeling our my daughter's bathroom, which she's happy and not happy about all that because it's going to throw a kink in it. But she starts back to school the same as your kids and all that. She starts her senior year. You know, last week was her birthday. She turned 17. This week she's going to be a senior in high school. So,
man,
it's official.
I remember the day she was born.
Mm-hmm. You remember the day that my son was born?
Yeah, that's true.
And the day he was conceived.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I was there.
Folks, y'all always want to hear, like we talked about, with some crazy stories that's happened to me and Kyle. I'll share one with y'all right quick. Kyle had a party at his house. This is we teased about talking about this a while back. Kyle had a party at his house. We were in high school.
Oh, boy.
And he would have several parties at his house. They had a big game room that they had added onto their house. It was large, and everybody would look like Jonestown after it. You know what I mean? And we're not talking. We wouldn't all show up with like warm milk and Bible study. We would go hard in the paint at these places, right? I mean, it's all nighters and drinking and everything else. So I'm going to sleep in his little brother's room, but his little brother come home and all that stuff. So there's people in his little brother's room and Kyle and I. So I'm like, oh, I'll sleep on the couch, right? Well, that don't happen. So there's people all over the couch. I can't find a place to sleep. And allegedly, I'm highly intoxicated at this point. So only place I can think of is in my mind, I'm like, well, I know where there's a big soft bed in Kyle's mom and dad's room. Nobody's in there except his mom and dad. So I slip into the bedroom and I ease the door closed and I climb up in between his mother and father and slide down in between the sheets. I got a California King and I slide down in between the sheets and pass out, hammered drunk, pass out. I don't think nothing of it. I'm sleeping. Right? Next thing I know, I feel his thump, thump on the bottom of the foot of the bed. I crack my eye open, a terrible hangover, and his dad is standing there fully dressed and he's kicking the bed. And he's like, breakfast is ready. Come on, it's time to get up. I'm like, yes, sir. Climbed up out of bed, went and ate breakfast. They let me sleep. Apparently, his mom woke up. It was just one of those things. So
she
yeah.
said that she was always worried about us youngsters. That if you were in the bed with her, she knew you were safe and okay. So she just rolled over and went back to bed.
Yeah, so that's one of the stories. It was real. You can't say you're proud of those facts, but hey, look, I was safe. Man, I didn't feel safe the next day.
Yeah.
I felt like I'd been violated the next day. But yeah, there's another story that happened.
Crazy. Well, let's get into the news, folks. Check this out. This comes from Open Minds. It's about a regular occurring UFO that outran some jets.
Awesome.
Says on several occasions in 1975, Yugoslavian Air Force jets saw a strange multicolored glowing orb, but every time they tried to investigate it, it would outrun their jets.
Teasing.
Finally, after many failed attempts to get closer and to get a closer look, and facing ridicule for reporting these incidents, they decided to just choose and ignore it. Now, this is according to a General Zvonimir Djurjevic, former commander of Air Force and Air Defense of Yugoslavia.
I bet he has a hard time finding a keychain with his name on it.
Right? The story was first revealed in 2011 in a book on the 972 Aviation Regiment, which was led by Djurjevic. He recently discussed the UFO encounters again in an interview with Sputnik International. According to Djurjevic, the UFO encounters began in January 1975 and lasted for several days. Every night, 50 minutes after takeoff, he would encounter the same object. The object looked like a glowing orb. He said it was very well visible, maybe 10 times lighter than the brightest star at the moment. Now, Djurjevic told Sputnik International that the color constantly changed from white to yellow to light red to orange and again back to white. It appeared from nowhere unexpectedly, and it appeared the same place night after night at the same time into my flights. He says it was attracting attention on purpose, he thinks. He said, now, Djurjevic was not the only one to see this object, and many of the pilots in his regiment also reported the same thing while out on their flights. Now, Djurjevic recalls that on January 25th, he decided to attempt to get a closer look. However, Once he headed towards the object, it took off at an amazing rate. Soon afterwards, Georgievich devised a better plan to catch the object off guard. He recruited the pilots of three other aircraft to join him on this hunt. And on that night, in late January, Georgievich and other aircraft took off unannounced. Two other jets took off soon after. They had decided not to inform anyone of their plans or discuss it on the radio, just in case the object was related to some sort of monitoring of their movements by a foreign country. He said, "I only just stabilized the flight somewhere over this town I will not try to pronounce, when suddenly the object flashed over Budvudva, and Lieutenant Mekik saw it above Niksik. I ordered Mekik to stay in place and took a course parallel to the Adriatic coast. When I tried to establish at what distance the object was, it turned out it was about 10 kilometers away. And it says 10 kilometers was as close as I could get. The object would match my speed and movements no matter what I did. So if I increased my speed, the object would increase its speed. If I slowed down, the object would slow down. But it always kept a constant pace of around 10 kilometers away from me." And that says he was flying in a Soviet MiG-21. And so him, as well as many other pilots to this day, said that they saw the thing on several of flights around the same time another flight. And then just as abruptly as it started, it was gone and they never saw it again. And they don't know what it was.
I like it, the fact that it's like laying in wait for them, waiting to just bring it out there and mess. It's just a kid flying. I just want to play with you guys, man.
Well, it seems like, you know, we've heard many times where they talk about how it looks like the thing is trying to toy with people.
Yes.
And I think it is. I think that whatever intelligence is controlling this thing, it's watching them, trying to mess with them. And then it's at any moment, it just goes. Because I've heard of other cases where people actually fired upon them, but you never hit one.
Yeah. Oh, just messing around.
Yeah, messing around.
I love the fact, though, it seems like it was just waiting just for him to take off. When you get taken off, like, all right, that's the one. We're going to go out and play with this guy. This guy's got fun toys. And you come riding back out there with it.
Yeah.
I can't. How defeating would it be to try to tell your superiors this? You know, and they don't want to hear. Because, if, like we've already talked about, you come forward too much of that, they'll ground you because they think you're losing your mind.
Right, yeah. You don't want to lose your pilot's license. Right? Taking you a long time to get it.
Try to get up there, and then you go crazy. Hey, ever since the Dark Waters episode that we had, I've received a bunch of emails. You know, it's talking about sightings down in Louisiana and Mississippi and all that. And then, of course, driving through there, going down to Florida and all this. Well, I got one sent to me by Paul. And this is a really cool link that he sent from the BFRO. And it was a sighting that took place in January of this year, 2017. That's not Dogman. It is a Bigfoot sighting. But it's really interesting. Now, we're talking about in Grant Parish County, and it's the nearest town is Colfax, Louisiana, which is actually basically north central Louisiana.
Okay.
Is where it's at down there. And it's off of D'Artigo Road, it says, on the to the Church of God, the woods behind the church. So it's in there behind a church. This is what was actually observed. It says, since October, I have heard many howls, wood knocks, and eye shines that I've seen. I believe that they have been frequented in the hardwoods across the street. But since the recent logging of thousands of acres of pine in this area, that they've taken up full-time residency across the street. Now, there is a large swamp that butts up to these hardwoods. And the person goes on, it says, the night of January 21st of 2017 was the most incidental of all so far. After making some calls on my front porch, I got a wood knock from the woods across the street. My dog ran towards the activity and barked for a long time. When I heard his collar stop jingling and the barking stopped, I got worried. And I went into the woods, and get a load of this, Kyle. Went into the woods with a large limb. This person's packing a limb in there to go defend the dog. I beat against a large oak and yelled, "I want my dog." And I heard a wood knock close, real close, and then a chest beat and a bluff charge through the brush. It says, then a tree pushed down. I yell and roared, basically saying, "I want my dog," and beat hard against the tree. This time I saw eye shine ahead, and I told him to back away so my dog would come to me and we'll go home. He did, and my dog came out and we went home. Now, also, this person, when it turned this whole story in, had noticed that there was things happening for over 10 years. Chickens were being stolen. Watermelons out of the field were being taken. Noticed that they were like noises and like you could see movement and things up against the windows at night. So it sounds like they have like a habitation site, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the story goes that it's only one witness. This is how it goes. And it's down on this hardwoods and this swamp. Now, this is an interesting thing because the BFRO investigator named Carter Bouchard went down there to this area, okay?
Okay.
And this is what Carter wrote. It says, I spoke with this witness on several occasions. Now, he lives alone in a secluded area with his dog, Bubba. Across the street from him is a massive swamp, along with what he says is a good-sized hardwood forest that adjoins this swamp.
Right.
Now, he goes on to say that across the street from his home is the Church of God, and then on the main road there, and he said there's an abandoned house in it. This is what Carter was talking about. And he said that the fellow that did this report is fairly certain that this house was abandoned years ago because the swamp was growing, you know, was basically filling with more and more water, surrounded the house. Now, the guy goes on to say that he was familiar with that, and so he was actually doing these wood knocks and stuff himself when he detected the activity of these creatures, when he would have these encounters. But here's one thing really interesting. He says, on the evening of January 21st of 2017, as stated, that he was sitting on his front porch with his dog making these wood knocks and he would get these responses. He said that there was some very heavy rustling in the woods at this time. All right. So before the dog even went out, the whole thing, that there was a lot of noise going on in the woods before he made the wood knock. So he said the heavy rustling. So who really knows? Maybe there was stuff passing through. We don't know. But he indicated that though his dog is, this is what this fella says, big and bad, that he would get very submissive, of course, when you talk, you know, when you get on to him, like when the dogs, you know, right, get in trouble, like most dogs, when you get on to them, they don't get mad at the owner. He said that after he heard the collar, you know, he didn't hear the bark anymore, that he heard a faint whimpering. And that's what made him go back in there to start trying to find out what was going on. And he talks about seeing the eye shine. He talks about a lot of this stuff. He also shows these photos, and you go and look, it's like anything else. You can't see anything but brush. You would have to really know what this photo was going to be about, but you can see how thick it is when you see these. But Carter reports on this, says early February, this fellow took his riding mower across the street to mow a path to the woods and the swamp. I guess so he could walk the dog or go in there how he wanted to.
Yeah.
Now, he said this is very tall grass, and it leads to a small clearing and gives minimal access to the swamp and forest behind him. Now, he mows this path, so he has a better chance to see, and this is what he says, avoid brown recluse spiders and snakes in that area. So he's making him a little trail. He said he mows it every 2 or 3 weeks. The guy had just finished mowing and gotten off the riding mower when he saw a fresh footprint. He said so fresh that water was still slowly seeping in, filling it. Which basically meant that less than a minute before, this creature had stepped out behind him while he was on this mower. So he had, and he didn't see it. Now he says he sees others. So this guy's taking a picture of the footprint. The man that made this report wears a size 12 shoe. He said that this footprint alone is 17 and a half inches.
Jeez.
Imprinted down into the ground. So he goes on to talk about thinking. He also says that he'd found more footprints in this area. And that the gate alone would be something that would be hard for a person to make. You know, you're talking about taking long steps. We've discussed that before. Long strides, long steps. He also says this. This is the thing I like the most. That he felt. Now, when he saw this, he said he heard something sloshing through the woods, is what he said, with like human steps. It's not like a deer or something. It sounds 1 foot in front of the other. He said he got a feeling of uneasiness that he needed to get out of there, and it stood the hair up on the back of his neck. So that's yet again one of those feelings that we talk about that kind of overtakes him. But I really like this is what Carter said. Carter said that he had spoken to this witness numerous times, said he never at any point got any indication of this person wanting to embellish the story, felt like he was hoaxing it to get attention, nothing. Carter said that he felt like this person was extremely sincere about the activity that's been happening across from his house. So I thought it was interesting that in those swamps and in those hardwoods, which is what Dark Waters had talked about, in those areas, it's very deep, thick stuff. There's almost like habituation sites. That's what this sounds like. Like he's seeing all this on a routine. Now, why they don't go out and set up more cameras or try to, who knows? You know, we always speculate at all. You have no idea. You know, I mean, who knows at all at this point? But it does seem like there's more to it than just a blurred chance encounter driving down the road, something like that. Like this person, when he said for decades now, you know, for over 10 years, he's had chickens go missing. Yeah. Watermelons go missing. You add up like, yeah, could it be people? It could be people. It could be foxes. It could be bobcats taking the chickens, hawks, owls. It can be real easy.
I've heard that grab many times when it comes to Sasquatch or Bigfoot that they like to go in chicken coops and steal chickens and eggs.
It's strange. Who doesn't like eggs? Come on. You don't like chicken?
I love chicken.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I love chicken. Not a fan of watermelon, but you know.
Oh, I like watermelon.
I'm not a big fan.
I love it. I like cantaloupe. I like watermelon. I like Oh, what's the one I'm thinking of? It's another type of melon. I can't think of the word right now. They're kind of green.
Cassava?
No. But I like all types of stuff. Like
honeydew?
That. Yeah, honeydew. That's it. I love honeydew. I like mangoes. I like all that stuff.
So if you was a Sasquatch, you'd for sure be breaking in or stealing watermelons and chickens and all that stuff. Wouldn't you be down with it?
For sure.
Harassing the dogs?
Yeah. Dog might be good to eat. I don't know. I've never had it. But you're a Sasquatch. It might be good. It might be tasty.
Right. You have to cook it up. Nah, he just wants a pet. He just wants a pet on it.
I wonder if Sasquatch does cook. I mean, do we have any proof that shows that they make little campfires?
I don't think they would, because if they started a fire, they'd be easier to find.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't think they cook. I think everything they eat's raw. I wonder if they have pets. I'm being honest here. It's crossed my mind over these several years, is if Bigfoot takes a pet. What if he finds like a baby coyote or, you know, baby, what if he raises it up? Just the idea of Bigfoot walking with like a coyote or a wolf as a pet. Or maybe that's another reason he gets alerted. They're all working together. He's got his pets out there. He's like, remember the old movie Beastmaster?
Yeah, I remember that show.
Yeah, maybe he's like Beastmaster.
Oh, man, that's an interesting. Maybe you're right. Maybe he has the animals working for him. That's why you can never find him, because they're always alert him well ahead of time.
Well ahead of time, yeah.
I know there's lots of sightings where people say the woods go dead quiet. I mean, like, no birds singing, nothing. And that's when they'll have their encounter. So, you might be onto something. Who knows? Checking out, this is a pretty cool article I saw about the Demon of Sprayton. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
I haven't either. It's pretty interesting. It says, in November 1682, Francis Fay was a 20-year-old servant in the service of Philippe Furzy, who was a landowner who lived in the little English village of Sprayton. One day, while in a field near his employer's house, Francis was puzzled to see Philip's father outside. The elder Furzy was walking with his staff and, like the many moles he once whacked, had long been dead. Fortunately, old Furzy's ghost had no intention of whacking Francis. Instead, Furzy had returned from the dead to sort out some problems with his will. He explained that two beneficiaries were each owed 10 shillings, and a sister in a nearby town of Totnes was owed 20. So as long as all three beneficiaries got their money, Furzy promised not to haunt Francis. So Francis ran to the first two beneficiaries without any problems. Now, Furzy's sister in Totnes was a bit more difficult. She refused to take her share, suspecting it had been sent by the devil. That night, Furzy appeared to Francis again, telling him to buy a ring worth 20 shillings. So Furzy's sister had no qualms with the ring, so Francis figured he was free and headed back for home. As part of their agreement, though, Furzy should have left Francis alone, but as Francis rode into Sprayton, Furzy materialized as a ghost again. Unfortunately, this time, the ghost did have the intention of beating Francis. It appeared behind Francis as he rode his horse, clinging to his waist and then throwing him to the ground. The fun didn't stop there. Once Francis got back to Philip's farm, his horse jumped and landed 25 feet away. Things only got worse from Francis from there. It says the elder Furzy never showed up again, but now a second ghost, that of Furzy's equally dead wife, began to haunt the poor young man. This specter, nicknamed the Demon of Sprayton, delighted in all sorts of bizarre cruelty. It says her harassment of Francis, who thought she was a good person while she was alive, is a long list of baffling tortures. Now, normally, the Demon of Sprayton looked as she did when she was alive, but sometimes, however, she appeared as a fire-breathing dog, and on occasion she became a horse and jumped through a window, shattering only a single pane of the glass. She also ripped the clothes off Francis and another servant and took pleasure in grabbing wigs off of people's heads. The demon could be pretty violent, it says. In one incident, invisible hands seized Francis and bashed his head against the wall. The attack was so bad that a doctor examined Francis and, for reasons of 17th century medicine, decided to bleed him. After the doctor was done, the ligatures on Francis's flew off, wrapped around his waist, and nearly suffocated him. In another incident, Francis's shoelace became undone all by themselves. One of the laces flew out of Francis's shoe, traveled to the other side of the room, and then tried crawling back to the other shoelace.
What?
When a maid who saw everything grabbed the freewheeling lace, it curled around her hand, it says, like an eel. The day before Easter, the demon grabbed Francis outside and carried him into the air, it says, upside down. And when the other servants of the house realized Francis was missing, they searched for half an hour until he was found delirious, somewhere in a nearby bog. He sang and whistled in a strange trance, and his wig was found on the top of a tree branch. So all this crazy stuff is said to happen to this Francis guy because I guess he didn't divide up the money that was left by the Fursey, his employer's dad or something.
All I know is that's...
This poor guy, Francis, was tormented by this demon, the demon of Sprite.
Yeah, the shoelace thing. I'm out, baby.
You see the thing crawling across the floor like an inchworm? Anyways, there's much more to this story. It's pretty interesting. Just search the demon of Sprite, or you can click on the show notes.
That's crazy.
I'll put links to it, but it's an insane story. I've never even heard of this thing.
That's crazy. You probably pronounced Sprite wrong or whatnot. You're going to get a lot of emails.
I'm sure I will. Yeah, I'm sure the word police will come after me. Here's a little tip, folks.
Here we go.
If you're the word police and you're trying to correct on the way I pronounce something, save your time. It doesn't, I don't care.
I'm going to pronounce it the Thames River. If you don't want to pronounce Thames, don't spell it that way. And on with the show, I'm going to clickorlando.com, folks.
Uh-oh.
Orlando. That's right. Florida man's at it again. Titusville, Florida, this time. Thrift shop bargain hunters find rare NASA flight suits.
Mm.
Talia Rapa and Skylar Answorth turned summer bargain shopping at a Titusville thrift store closeout into the stuff of NASA collector's legend. Says when the Central Florida college student, get a load of this now, paid 20 cents each for five rare NASA flight suits that experts say could be valued at $5,000 each or more.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Now, Rapa told the News 6 this, that they were kind of in a weird corner. Now, Skylar pulled them out at first, then brought the whole handful over to me, is what Rapa says. Says the five blue NASA flight suits, along with the white control suit, were in the bottom of a plastic bin, tucked under some forgotten winter sweaters. Now, it says, according to experts at the American Space Museum, the astronauts' names and flight dates on the white labels seem to match the times that astronauts George Pinky Nelson, with a PhD, of course, Robert A. Parker, PhD, and Charles D. Walker, a payload specialist, flew shuttle missions between 1983 and 1985. Now, at first, experts thought that Nelson's flight suit, a 38 small, was worn by Florida Senator Bill Nelson. But further investigation showed Senator Nelson didn't fly a shuttle mission until 1986. So it says Rapa is a junior at UCF studying astrophysics, told News 6 that she's always been fascinated with space travel and would love to be part of the Mars mission. And when the 20-year-old looked at the suits close up, she admits her jaw dropped. That says Skylar Answorth, 24, who was recently accepted into a college aerospace program at Eastern Florida State College, told News 6, the space program is in his family DNA. Says, my parents worked NASA communications with the shuttle program, and my grandfather even worked communications with the shuttle.
Wow.
Says, it just blows my mind. This is what Skylar says. It, being that the bin holding the suits was under two other big totes. I moved them off to the side, and I'm digging through a whole bunch of sweaters and stuff, and I found the white one with the patch just kind of laying there. Now, Chuck Jeffrey is a member of the board of the American Space Museum in Titusville and an avid NASA collector. Purchased the fifth flight suit worn by the STS-9 astronaut Dr. Owen Garrett. Now, Garrett was an amateur radio ham operator and is also known as the first man in space to communicate via the ham radio with people across the globe while aboard the Columbia STS-9. Now, the students plan to offer the suits at a special auction conducted by the American Space Museum. Now, the date for this auction has been set for November 4th. Now, some of the proceeds will be donated to the museum. It says, while the other funds will be used for the Rapa and Answorth college tuition. So they're going to do it to pay. But could you imagine coming across that?
No,
I can't. A piece of space history.
That's incredible.
In a tub, in a thrift shop in Titusville, Florida. So yet again, somebody, I wonder if it was some of those things that it was, they were packed up and maybe they were brought home by accident.
Well, there was a pair of gloves, I think, were found this way.
All kinds of wild stuff.
I think some moon rocks were found this way. I mean, NASA is, they're really good at going really far, but they're just not really good at, like, keeping stuff.
Are they?
Taking care of it.
Are they?
Oh, here we go.
Are they? I mean, it does make you wonder when this is how you handle all your other stuff. You're like, oh, yeah, we lost the video footage of that. Oh, we lost some moon rocks. We lost these clothes.
Well, you know, that's a good point because I know for a fact that they gave away some moon rocks to some of these other countries as, like, a good faith
and
token of generosity, and it turned out years later that those aren't from the moon.
So,
you know, this is the Nefeed conspiracy theorist. Did we really go to the moon or not? Or is, yeah, we went to the moon, but we just gave these other countries these fake rocks because they're like, well, they'll never know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Knowing the way U.S. is kind of an ass about things, we were probably just like, hey, just grab some out of the parking lot and give it to them. They don't know any better.
Right, exactly.
That's probably how they did it.
That's exactly right.
I'm not sharing my moon rocks with these fools.
Yeah. It's like Jacob wanted a pair of Oakley sunglasses. I bought some fake ones. Spent like $20 and gave it to him. He doesn't know the difference. But you think I'm going to spend $200 on a pair of sunglasses for a 10-year-old kid? You're crazy. But I never told him. He thinks they're real. No.
He don't know. It's fine.
It's like, man, these are awesome, man. Thanks. I'm like, no problem.
You're number one dad. You're like, hey, I bought you 2 pair.
Here, I'll just take a pair out and stomp on them in the gut.
Buy those ones from China that say, like, you can $10, you get 6 pair in a box and just bring them all
over.
Well,
that's funny. It's like every time me and my wife go to New York City, we go down there off Canal Street and you can buy fake purses and handbags and pocketbooks and things. She always does. And she's like, I would never spend the actual money for what these cost because that's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, but does your friends know? She's like, no, they think it's the real thing.
So she's a liar. That's what it is. You're married to a liar.
Oh, amongst many other things.
Folks, we're going to take a break. When we get back, I'm going to be talking about some very odd disappearances. You could say caught on film. That's about the only way I know to put it, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Love your show this week about war and the UFOs, but I had a really interesting story to tell you. A friend of mine's brother, Kelly, was a CB in Vietnam, and they would fly these guys into the jungle, and then they'd clear landing zones for the helicopters as they kind of hip-hopped around in the jungle, and they dropped them off in some pristine old jungles. And as they're clearing out this one area, they hear this intense buzzing noise, and it's like coming in and they're looking for helicopters or planes or something that's making this noise, and it's coming at them and it's getting louder and louder and closer and closer, and they can't see anything. They don't know what it is, and all of a sudden, you know, they can hear it coming really loud at them, and boom, it lands in the middle of where they're clearing this area in the jungle, and it's the hugest beetle they've ever seen in their life. It's like over, you know, a foot and a half long by a foot wide. It's jet black, and it was just bizarre. And they think everything got stirred up with them rooting around there. And I asked them, well, did you kill it or capture it? And they're like so freaked out by it, it just kind of rooted around a little bit and then took off. And that's what they came across in the middle of jungles of Vietnam. They just really couldn't believe what they saw. That they would occasionally, you know, root up snakes and weird stuff like that. But to have this ginormous beetle fly in to where they were clearing the landing zone just freaked everybody out. They never saw another one after that. So I looked online and I really have never found anything like what they saw. So I thought you'd find that interesting. This is Denise, who occasionally calls up and bugs you. Okay, bye.
And we are back, and let's get into some crazy stories.
Yeah, let's.
Who don't love crazy stories?
I love them. The crazier, right? The better.
The crazier, the better. Just you like your stories like you like your women. The crazier, the better.
Right.
Look, I guess I'm getting bad now. I'm getting hung up on all these vanishing and missing things. I've been binge listening to other podcasts, a lot of other true crime podcasts, and Up and Vanished is one of them. You know, I listen to all these wild stuff of like true crime, missing people. I'm just fascinated by it because it's one of those things we've always talked about. Could it be serial killers? Could it be foul play? Yeah, I'm sure the majority of it is like that. But then some of it seems like they just, like we've covered the missing hunters and things, they're just gone. They're just, where, you know, just where do you go? You just poof, gone. Yeah. Now, it's one thing to go missing, like we've always said, like either on the water or out in the middle of the woods or whatnot. It's a whole other thing to just vanish inside a city. When you vanish around people and you're in these areas, and there almost always seems to be foul play involved in those. You know, it's one thing to be an accident, but you'd think if you just had an accident and were dead, somebody would come across you. it doesn't seem to be like that all the time. So I'm going to talk about some of these that were actually captured on film. And when I say on film, I'm talking like security and surveillance cameras didn't get the people just like vanishing in air, like a flash of light or a puff of smoke, like a ninja, and they're gone. I'm talking like they had them at this time. They can see it on video when these people were there and what they were doing. And then, boom, they were gone. I'm going to start out with this one here from a German tourist, a 28-year-old at the time named Lars Mittank. Now, Lars, this goes back into 2014, in the summer of 2014, June 30th. Lars went to a place called Golden Sands in Bulgaria. Now, he went with a group of his buddies, you know, some friends all going to take a trip in the summer. For those that don't know anything about Golden Sands, I'm not the one to tell you because I don't know a lot about Golden Sands outside of this, that it's a very popular little resort town that a lot of young Europeans like to go to there because it has a great party scene. So you can imagine this is where everybody wants to go to get the friction they freak on, right? Everybody's going to go get you drink and party on. That's what it is. So this whole group gets there. They stay at this hotel. This hotel is called the HVD Viva Hotel. Now, they were planning on staying about a week there. They were going to head back home July 7th. Now, you can read some different places that they were going to actually, the whole group was going to be on like a full month-long party fest, but they were only staying at Golden Sands in this area for like 7-8 days is all they were planning on. So, like I said, they're going to leave on July 7th was the idea. Well, so they land. Now, this is, like I said, June 30th they get there. I said practically as soon as they arrived at this hotel, which was on July 6th when they get to the hotel, some trouble already breaks out, right? Lars is already gets caught up. He's at the beach. They're partying. There gets to be a little fisticuff action down there. What ends up happening? Lars gets hurt in the fisticuffs. And it you could say it's kind of a serious injury. He hurts his ear. Now, I know it's crazy to say, but he messed his ear up. Inner ear, not just you don't get punched in the ear. Yeah, you know, you punch me in the ear. No, it's like a cup slap, pop an eardrum type stuff. Mm. So he goes to the doctor. He swings into the doctor. The doctor's like, yeah, it's not good. You know, this, that, and the other. I'm going to give you some antibiotics. Puts him on these antibiotics. So the whole group goes ahead with their plans, right? So they keep partying for the rest of the vacation. So when it's time for Lars and all them to go back to what they said was Germany, they were going to swing back. It's time for him to go there. The doctor's like, man, it's not really safe for you to fly yet. Your eardrum hasn't healed up properly enough for that cabin pressure change. So it's going to be terrible. You don't need to fly. So Lars is like, man, okay, well, you know, what would it take? A few more days. Okay, great. Give me a few more days here. I like partying here. I like hanging out. I'll just stay here. Well, all of his friends decide they want to stay with him. Hey, Lars, we're going to hang out with you. He's like, dude, you know, I'm 28 years old. I'm a grown-ass man. I'll be fine, right?
Yeah.
I'll hang out. Y'all go ahead and go. So, you know, reluctantly, a bunch of friends, you don't want to bail out on your buddies, but you're like, okay, we're going to go ahead and get out of here. So they all flew back. So Lars goes to this place. He gets a room at a place called Color, and it's a local hotel there, and it's in the center of Varna. So he checks in there, and it's cheap. That's the reason he got there. He's just going to, you know, hang out, whatnot. Well, the night he checks into that hotel, he calls his mom there in Germany, which is great. You know, guy's going to call his mother and whatnot. But he says this. He says that he's having a problem. He's sound real anxious on the phone, a little upset. He tells his mom that he feels like he's being followed. He doesn't feel safe in this hotel. And he does this. He goes on. He claims to her that four men are following him. And he says that they wanted to know what the tablets were. That's all it was, what the tablets were. Well, he wanted to cancel his credit cards, and he said that there was something strange about this hotel. So It's almost like is he losing it? You know, I mean, what just happened? Well, hearing that, his mom books him on an airplane, and then from the airplane, a bus ticket for home the next day. So she, you know, she's like, I've already got it paid for. I got it booked. I don't care what it takes. Get here. This is July 8th. So on that day, Lars goes back to the Varna airport. He gets in a taxi, jumps in there, and he goes back to the Varna airport. Well, apparently there's an airport doctor in these areas. I don't know why you have to go see an airport doctor. I don't know if they put you on a list. I have no idea how this works. But he goes to this airport doctor, and he was hoping that the airport doctor would be like, thumb up, you're good to go. The strange thing is, you can see the video on the security cam there in the airport of Lars walking into the airport. Now, he's carrying a backpack, red and black backpack. He's also got a large duffel bag. He's toting that in his right hand and whatnot. He's got on jorts, is what he's wearing. It's jean shorts. He's got his jorts on and a yellow short-sleeved shirt. Now, in this video, he stops and he's talking to a woman. Now, you can tell in the conversation that he looks like he's asking or something. Nobody really knows. The speculation is he's trying to find out where the doctor's at, the medical services place is. You follow some more of the video trail. He goes to this medical place. And in that area, he's there for about 45 minutes in this area. While at this medical place, they say there's an unknown male. They don't know who this male is. But he's dressed like a construction worker. I'm assuming, you know, that he's got on his boots, his jeans, maybe like some crazy, you know, reflective jacket, you know, he's wearing. But he looks like a construction worker. It's at this point on the video when they're seeing this surveillance footage that Lars sees this guy. And when Lars sees him, visibly he changes. Visibly he becomes a little more anxious, a little more nervous. You can tell there's something going on. You know, like you can tell when you see it on people, the way they start acting. They get a little bit more agitated in their movements. Movements are getting a little bit larger. So you don't really know what's going on. But in the video, Lars turns back to the doctor and speaks to the doctor, then jumps up, leaving his backpack and his luggage, and starts running. He sprints out of the airport. Okay.
Yeah.
Clears the doors, jogs all the way across the parking lot to the fence around the parking lot, climbs up and over that fence, and keeps running until he's out of view of the camera. The parking lot surveillance camera can no longer see him running away from that place.
Okay.
He has never been seen after that. Wow. Ran completely away from it. Now, the doctor that Lars was there later on claimed that at first when Lars came in, he was completely calm, completely normal. Nothing was wrong with him. Everything seemed, he was as cool as a cucumber, okay?
Yeah.
And then he said all of a sudden, like almost instantly, like the flip of the switch, the doctor said that he seemed to have changed or flew into an uncontrollable panic. And he said the only thing that changed was that construction worker that they were talking about. That person walked into the clinic. The doctor said, I don't know what happened, but it completely changed Lars instantaneously. And then he ran off and he left everything through there, everything behind. So you're talking about, you could see going on the run to get away from somebody, but why would leave your clothes, your money, all of everything? You just had what was in your pocket and you just sprinted to get away from there, which is very, very strange. Now, like I said, nobody's seen anything of him. When he left that, he was gone for good. Now, there's been people come forward over the last few years claiming that they had come in contact with him. One of them was a truck driver from Bulgaria. And this truck driver claims that he had picked up what he said was a ragged hitchhiker. And that this ragged, now this was like a year or so later, he picks this guy up. And he said that it looked almost identical to the posters of Lars, the missing man that he had seen was Lars. Hmm. But they said they never could track it down. I guess he picked him up, took him somewhere. That was it. We don't know. Now, many people believe this. They believe that Lars had gotten into some trouble with some people there in Bulgaria and that he had made some enemies. That maybe while he was partying, maybe he had got into the drug scene. We don't really know. Maybe the people he got into a confrontation with, you know, you really don't know. I always think about like the movie Taken, something along those. You don't know what circles of people you're messing with. Maybe the guys that he messed with had some people in the government. You know, you've listened to Crime Town. I've listened, you know what I mean? You start listening to that. Yeah. You're kind of like, man, maybe so. You go on there. The doctor says that, man, it went from a normal dude to extreme panic and paranoia almost instantly. So whatever was going on, it's not like everything was cool and he just walked around the corner and was never seen again. There was some kind of
and he had some fear when he was talking to his mom.
Yeah, he had some fear about that, but he never come forward and said what it was.
Yeah.
So the last thing you see is him sprinting out, leaving his stuff, climbing up, and then vanishing off the planet, basically.
And so, it wasn't like he was a gambler and like had had been an incredible
that needed to hide
sporting event and then wasn't paying. No. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I don't know. That's very strange.
Yeah, it is very, very strange. There's another one here that I want to talk to you about that come from Dublin, Ireland back in 2000. So any of the Irish listeners and all, you're going to know exactly who I'm talking about. On December 8th, Trevor Dealey. Trevor Dealey was a 22-year-old fella that went missing. And he had actually gone out drinking, of course, at a hotel there with some of his buddies that he worked with from his job. Now, he worked at the Bank of Ireland as an assets management there. And of course, after they get off work, you can let your hair down, right? You're 22 years old. You're working at the bank. Like, let's go have a cold drink. I mean, heck, I'm almost 42 years old. I'd like to go have one. What's wrong with that?
Yeah.
So they headed off to this nightclub. You know, they're gonna go party. They said around 3:30 in the morning, Trevor decides he's going to head back to his office, and he goes back to his office with one of his buddies from work, Carl Pender. They're going to go have some, they had coffee, basically. And that's, I guess, what the whole plan was. Let's go back, have some coffee, and I'm going to grab an umbrella because, it's kind of rainy and all this stuff. He would then call one of his buddies named Glenn Cullen, and he left a voicemail saying that he had enjoyed the party that they had at the nightclub and that he was on his way home. He's like, hey, we left here. I went with Carl. We got some coffee. Of course, it depends on how hard you go in the paint, but usually when you get done drinking, it's not bad to have a little coffee. Sit down, kind of unwind, have some breakfast, hang out with your buddies. All right, I'm going to go back to the room. You call your buddy. Hey, Kyle, everything's going good. I'm out of here. It was great. I'll talk to you next time. This whole thing. That was the voicemail that this Glenn fella got. Trevor was never seen again. That was the last anybody heard from him was that whole deal. Gone. Now, the authorities, of course, the investigators on this thing, they start digging into this. They're like, what happened? Where'd he just go? Just a young kid at the bank, gone. Well, the detectives found some really strange little things that pointed to some stuff there on the closed circuit footage that night. The footage at work, okay? Mm-hmm. That building, the bank building, shows that when Trevor enters this building, that there was another guy. They said he's unidentified. Now, they use the term lurking in the doorway of that building. And they said it looked like he was maybe taking shelter from the rain because it was hard rain coming down. It's reason that Trevor had gone back, of course, to get his umbrella so, he could walk home. Said you can see him talking with this dude in the doorway briefly. And he said after that, the stranger goes across the road. So he crosses over. No big deal. You watch the footage, it goes on, and it shows that Trevor, that sometime later, he leaves the office and he's walking off. Now, they think it's because of a taxi strike, of course, that it affected at the time, okay? That's the reason it was all going on. But the very last known footage of Trevor shows him walk past an ATM. So I like how they can bounce through it, right? And they can follow you with those cameras.
Right.
He walks past an ATM at 4:14 in the morning. And in that video footage, said there's a man walking directly behind him carrying an umbrella. Now, they don't really go into this whole thing to say, was it the same person, this and that other. But they said it was right after this 4:14 thing. So they left at 3. So in an hour and 14 minutes later, Trevor's gone. Just poof, gone. Now, the investigators on this case believe that the person that Trevor could be talking with is the same one. This is what they think, possibly, not guaranteed, but possibly the same one in that ATM footage, the person that's following him. And they said that they believe that he followed Trevor, but they don't know because, you can't speculate as an investigator. You can go, okay, I think this and this and this, but you can't say, okay, he's the guy that caused the crime. He's the guy that did that. We don't know for sure till we can find out. But they said they do know this, that this figure that they seen Trevor talking to after he crosses the road, they believe that he might be waiting for Trevor to leave is what he's doing. He crosses over. They don't really know, of course, aside from the ATM footage, if there was any more interaction. Maybe he didn't. Maybe the person walking behind him just branched off. They really haven't got, too deep into this whole thing. Now, they did spend a lot of time trying to track down who this stranger could be, they say, but they think he could actually be somebody that they needed to talk to. He would have the key to what was going on. But they've not seen him. They can't. They don't know who he is, and they've never seen Trevor since. But there's an update, and when I say an update, folks, this is an update from August 14th of this year, of 2017, a few weeks ago, from the Irish News, was reported on by Ken Foy and Robin Schilner, and it talks about the lead investigator, Garday, and they're investigating that if a member of a well-known criminal family is responsible for the murder of Trevor Dealey, who went missing, it says almost 17 years ago. Detectives recently received information that alleges that Mr. Dealey, who was 22 when he disappeared in December of 2000, was shot before his body was dumped in West Dublin. Yeah, so now it's not just a vanishing. They finally come across it.
They found him. He's dead.
No, they haven't found him yet. Listen, they haven't found him. This person's claiming that he's done this. There's a 3-acre wooded site that they said this place that they're searching now. The information was received from an informant in recent months who has alleged that a well-known Crumlin criminal is responsible for Trevor's murder. It says, however, senior sources that night stressed that there were certain doubts in the statements that they had received, and they were adding that the information had to be acted upon. It says, while there are certain doubts in this case, Garotti was given an account of what happened to Mr. Dealey and where his remains were buried. Now, this is a senior source was reporting on this, and the information recently passed on, it said, it was not as a result of the public appeal from this year. It said the individual who has given information has not supplied any motive for the alleged murder of Trevor, but claimed that he was killed after having an interaction with the Crumlin criminal on the morning of his disappearance. Goes back into what they saw him talking to somebody in that doorway, right?
Right.
Says this alleged suspect, who cannot be named for legal reasons, is a well-known criminal who has been involved in various forms of criminality over decades. He's a convicted drug dealer who has operated in the South Inner City and South Dublin areas. His family has also been involved in a litany of crimes, including firearms offenses and the sale and supply of drugs. He goes on to say, two of his siblings who were involved in criminality are now deceased. Associates of the alleged suspect were involved in running street prostitution in the Bagot Street area at the time of Mr. Dealey's disappearance. Says the criminal gang have also been investigated for the unsolved murder of 21-year-old prostitute Sinead Kelly in the same locality in June of 1998. So this broke just a few weeks ago when they think that they may have found. Now, I know that they're gone out in this 3-acre area. They're digging, they're looking, they're trying to find the remains of Trevor Dealey. They haven't found him as of that I can tell, but they're still looking. They're still going on this whole, because they're going off this guy. Now, they did ask him. They're like, why would you come forward now? The way it sounds, this dude's fixing to spend a significant amount of time in prison, because he's in prison now. That's the reason. He was already in prison when he came forward to tell him. He said, I just can't live with this anymore. I can't go on knowing that that's what's going on. The problem is it's hard to trust people like that.
Yeah.
Is he just telling people that to throw it off the case of somebody else? Or is he just like, look, I'm going to be in here for life. I'll assume the responsibility of that to give his parents some rest, you know, to just let's wrap this up. I know I'm a bad person. I know what y'all are going to do to me. I'll go ahead and just go ahead and take a mark on this one, too. I don't know.
I don't know, man.
It is strange that that's the way he vanished, that it was they found it. So it's almost like they saw the guy in the doorway. They saw the guy at the ATM. Then it comes forward to this. It doesn't seem like Trevor was involved in drugs or anything like that. It just seems like maybe he was at the wrong time. Maybe the guy thought that they could get Trevor to let him into the bank, rob the bank, and Eric. You know, who knows? It's hard to speculate. Who knows? But it was very odd that they knew they needed, that's the guy they needed to talk to. Sounds like this is the guy that did it, was the one they wanted to talk to. They just caught him years later. He finally confessed. Now, it doesn't just happen overseas. It happens here also.
Really?
Dale Kersetter. Now, get a load of this. This happened in 1987, September 12th of 87, about 11 p.m., Dale Kersetter shows up to work the overnight shift as a security guard at the Corning Glassworks plant in Bradford, Pennsylvania. Now, he's 50 at the time. Now, Dale was a divorced father of six, and he had worked at this plant, Kyle, for over 29 years. It's a little over 29 years. Okay, that's putting in your time, right?
Yeah.
The bad thing is this, that he had been transferred from this to this position he's at now. He was a trade worker. They moved him to a security guard. I don't know if it was maybe because of his age. Maybe they were changing, automating stuff. I don't know. You're talking 87, so we have no idea how this all goes. But they did say that when they transferred him, when they moved him over, he had to take a pay cut of close to $7,000 a year. That's the pay cut that he took. That's never a good thing. You know, never a good. A pay cut's never a good thing. Well, at 7 a.m. the next morning, so the morning of the 13th, okay, 7 a.m., Dale's relief partner arrives there, starts, you know, going to take over for security, and he notices, Dale's not here. Like, where the heck's he at? Well, he sees Dale's truck, goes over there to it, it's still in the parking lot. Not only is it still in the parking lot, the keys are still in the ignition of the truck. So he opens the door, he looks in there, well, Dale's little day pack that he carries, it's in there. Dale also bought a full carton of cigarettes. So, you know, 87, you know, you're smoking. You especially going to have a security job all night. What are you going to do? You're going to smoke cigarettes and drink coffee. And that's what any red-blooded American would do in the middle of the night, right?
Right. Sounds good
to me. So he's got a full carton of cigarettes in the truck. Nothing. And everybody knew Dale was a smoker. A cigarette, the carton ain't been broke open. Bag's still there. Along with the stuff like that in the truck, there's a holster for the .22 caliber pistol that he carried. Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah. The pistol was never found, just the holster. So you're like, what is going on here? Dale's keys to the plant. So all the doors in the plant for making his security rounds was sitting on top of a newspaper. And that newspaper was folded up on top of a table in the cafeteria. And in the cafeteria now, you could say there was still food laid out from where he was going to eat. Like his lunch he had laid out. This whole thing. All out there, food on it, uneaten. They were everything. Just set out there perfect. Like he'd got caught and vanished right in the middle of lunch break. Like
making his lunch.
Yeah. It's crazy. So what do they do? His buddy calls up. Everybody's like, look, our security guard's vanished. I'm the other security guard. We got to get this going on. They start bringing people in. They're like, we got to find out what's going on. Where's he at? What's happening? So everybody comes in. They start rallying at the plant, going crazy. They start doing a full sweep of the entire area, fence to fence, front to back, pillar to post. They're looking for Dale. No sign of him. He has vanished. As the word implies, he's gone. They bring a police dog in. They're like, we'll find him. They start tracking the scent. They go to the cafeteria first, right? They go from the cafeteria to the second floor up to the plant's glass furnace. So they're like, let's go check the security tapes. So they run back in there. They fire up the security tapes. Now, the plant has three security cameras. And the feed, of course, what's it do? It alternates, you know, at random intervals. Click, 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 as it records camera one to camera two, two to three, three to one, and it bounces around through there. At one point, around midnight, the footage shows that there is a masked intruder walking through the plant. And at various points in the plant, he's appearing at different areas. So between midnight and 1 o'clock, 1 a.m., mind you. So the cameras are picking him up in different areas all around the plant. And in one of these jumps, as it goes, one of these jumps, you can see that this masked intruder meets up with Dale in the back of the plant. Comes across. Okay. Yeah. And they both walk past a security camera together. And at one point during the footage of this whole thing, Dale looks directly up and into the camera for a bit of time. Like he's just staring at the camera. Now, police say this. They don't know if he was signaling for help or not. They can't tell. He's just looking at the camera. Nothing in this footage indicates whether Dale was being forced to do anything. Like, you can't tell him, you know, he's shoving him, he's got a pistol. Nothing. Nothing in that footage shows that. Nor does it show that they were working together. It's just like you walking, almost like the dude's invisible. Walk by, you just look at the camera, stare at it, just dead eye stare at it for a minute. That's it. So they said it's very difficult in this to tell if Dale was under any kind of duress or not at all. But what's strange is the plant manager, he come right out and said that he thinks he looks into the camera to taunt the people at the glass place, at the Corning place. This is what he was quoted saying. He said, I think the fact that he did everything in front of the cameras was once again just Dale saying to us, look, hey, here I am. I'm taking your platinum and there isn't anything you can do about it. Yeah, I said platinum.
Wow.
Get a load of this. After that shot of Dale staring at the camera, he never shows back up on the footage again. Now, there's one shot that shows this intruder heading towards the glass furnace. Well, as he's going towards the glass furnace, it's the same exact place where they picked up Dale's scent, where it ended, okay?
Okay.
Now, there's also a video shot comes through of this intruder. He's got a large bag on the manual forklift. You know those ones you drive around, you slide under the pallets and jack up and all that stuff? Well, he's got a large bag on this forklift, this handheld, you know, buggy pulling around there. So they see that. Now, they say that this bag is large enough to hold Dale's body. Dale wasn't a big man. Dale's like 5'5", 140 pounds. He's not like a, you know, you're not talking about you're getting rid of Andre the Giant or, you know, just a big, big old boy. Dale's just, you know, average guy. But they said that bag was large enough to hold Dale's body. But when they saw that, they were like, wait a minute, glass furnace, he's got this big bag. So they go up. They go to the glass furnace and find out that the lining of that glass furnace is lined with platinum had been stolen. It's $250,000 worth of platinum.
Wow.
Stolen out of that lining of that glass furnace. So they said, for everything that you see, visually, everything that you see, it appears that this, what they say, is this masked intruder forced Dale to go up there and show him where the platinum was, made him, help him load it all up and all that stuff, and then just killed him and disposed of his body.
Or Dale was working with this guy. It was a buddy of his.
Now you're getting there.
He said, look, we're going to rob the bank. on Wednesday. Okay, just, or not the bank, but the place. Yeah. So the Platinum. Dale knows that the Platinum's there. Yep. They're in it. There's a caper going. It's been planned. But he shows up early. He shows up on like a Monday. So Dale's in the middle of making a sandwich, not expecting his buddy. Uh-huh. His buddy comes in and is like, look, something came up. We got to do it now.
We got to go.
And then Dale's like, you're like you said, looking at the camera, taunting him. They steal it right then and there. And that's why Dale disappeared. I don't know, though.
Yeah. Well, you might be really onto something, because the Corning's management, they still think that that Dale's involved. Straight up, they think he's involved. They don't think that there was no other reason for him to walk by. They said if you were going to signal for help, that you would actually signal for help. That if you just stare at the camera where it can see your face, this is Corning's management, not the detectives, no investigators. This is the plant management. They believe that Dale, it feels like something that like the plant managers knew something more than what they were letting on. Well, it comes up. It's this. Investigators start digging into Dale. They found out that he'd been in some debt. Around $30,000 to $40,000 in debt is what Dale was in debt for, which that helped build the idea that maybe he was working with them. But what's really strange about this is he had family members and stuff and friends come out. They were like, this isn't Dale. This isn't what Dale would do.
And I was going to say it's just him and the guy with the hood.
Yeah.
Two guys.
Yeah.
So you're splitting the value of the Platinum, 200 yeah. something thousand. Are you really willing to walk away from your family your entire life for $100,000? I mean, it's not like that's a lot of money. It's not like it's $250 million. Uh-huh. It's $100,000. Uh-huh. That's nothing.
Dale's daughter, Wendy, she denies the fact that he was involved in any sort of crime adamantly, vehemently. She just denies it. This is what she said. If he had planned on taking off anywhere, why would you bother packing a lunch?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. And to desert your family. Look, if you were in trouble, like say whatever, you made a stupid mm-hmm. bet, you bet your life savings on Conor McGregor winning the fight.
Yeah.
And you owed it to some bookies and you knew you were in trouble. You wouldn't just desert your family. You'd be like, you'd tell them what time it is. Look, we're gonna get out of here. Y'all go ahead and meet me in the Bahamas. I'm going to clear up some things at work and I'll meet you there in 2 weeks. One of those kind of deals.
Yeah.
That's why I don't buy that the dude just decided to walk away from his family his entire life for $100,000.
Well, you're right there with his daughter. Because she goes on to talk about that. She said it's little things like what you're talking about. She says, Dad smoked all the time. Why would you buy a whole carton of cigarettes and then leave them in the truck?
Yeah.
So this is what she said. Dad had 6 kids, 2 grandkids. She goes, to take and do something like that and just take off and not call any of them and then never talk to your children again. She goes, I just don't believe that you would do that.
I don't believe it either.
And you're bringing up for $100,000. That's true. Why would you wouldn't do that? Like I said, so the management believes that Dale willingly helped them do all of this stuff and that he just took his share and just completely bounced. He's gone. The family does not believe that at all. Now, it's been, almost 30 years, and there's still no sign of Dale. So you can't tell me that after 30, the statute of limitations for that kind of is gone.
Yeah.
You know, you would tell me you would never come back. You don't ever want to see your grandkids. It's been almost 30 years. You would have great grandkids if you were still alive. You're talking about Dale would be in his 80s right now if he were still alive. You wouldn't just up and vanish.
I don't think so.
It's really strange, though, the fact of the whole idea of him looking in this camera. And they said that so I'm guessing, too, they probably checked the furnace. You didn't run the furnace. It's not like they burned up his corpse. It's not like they burned all that stuff up. He's right there was a smell. Then it was like, where did he go? Did that dude kill Dale? Did he make Dale help him and then kill him and put him in that bag and wheel him out of there and dump his body? Because I'm like, there's no, they've never found remains of him anywhere. They've never even been able to tie anybody to the heist. They've never been able to tie the Platinum to anything. I mean, it's just like when it left and there was nothing else to it.
Almost like the guy in the hood glammed him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like a vampire would.
Yeah, you're right.
I don't know. Put him under some kind of trance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, that's strange.
Yeah, well, I got you one more here. This comes from a fellow named Jesse Ross. Jesse Ross is a 19-year-old communications major there at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. And in 2006, Jesse was in Chicago to attend a United Nations meeting at the Sheraton Chicago Hotel and Towers. Now, he wasn't the only one, of course. There's about 1,200 other college kids there, all from around the country. So I'm sure it's a heck of a fun time. You know what I mean? I'm sure it's great.
Yeah.
It's a 3-day conference. And on the final day, what's going down? A dance, baby. We're going to have a dance. We're going to throw down.
Play some limbo.
That's right. That's right. It was 10 o'clock that evening. And it said nearby, they were on the Four Corners Sheraton. And it says that later that evening, that there was a United Nations Security Council meeting. And Jesse decided to attend that too. Story goes, or the reports go, that he left that meeting about 2 a.m. Now, they said he had been drinking, but he did not seem to be intoxicated. So people had talked to him like, yeah, he'd had a few drinks, but he's not smashed, you know. I mean, right. He's not falling down, sleeping with his friend's parents type drunk. He's just, you know, he's hanging out. So he told some other of his buddies, he's like, hey, I'm going to go back here and just take a quick little 30-minute break, right? So I'm going to catch a power nap. And we're going to keep rolling, right?
Mm-hmm.
He vanished. After he walked away from that group of friends, never been seen again. They said that the last known sighting of Jesse was on the security cameras on the hotel there in the elevator, and said he steps out into the lobby, okay? Walks out into the lobby, and then snap of fingers, Kaiser Soze, Jesse's gone. Gone, gone. Now, they thought that he had left the hotel in order to walk back to his own hotel. Now, that's the story, that he got out of that lobby, left it, walked back to his own hotel, and in between those two, because he was inebriated, in air quotes, he fell in the Chicago River. Now, we talk about some of the stuff of the people that go missing in the cities and stuff with David Pilatus's book. So this is kind of along that same thing. Maybe he fell in the Chicago River. The only problem was this, as it goes down. The street that he would have to go down to get to his hotel, he's only a 10-minute walk from one hotel to the other. So what are you talking about, a half-a-mile walk, quarter of a mile, depending on how fast you walk?
Right.
That street is lined with lights because so many people walk it back and forth. So it's extremely well lit. Not only is it extremely well lit, it's also lined with security cameras, Kyle. Security cameras from hotel to hotel.
Right, I'm with you.
All right?
Yeah.
Not 1 second of footage of Jesse leaving that hotel to walk to his other one. Not 1 second.
Now, how is that possible?
It's because he never left the original hotel. There's no footage of him anywhere on the premises after he's taken into that elevator there at the lobby. None of it. None of it. Nothing. Now, they've searched the grounds and everywhere around the hotel where he was last seen. Nothing. The police even brought divers in, not once or twice, multiple times, to swim the Chicago River up and down that area where they think he might have been, areas where they know things could wash to, things could stick to. Nothing. The police are so frustrated also because the vanishing, this, all this stuff took place right before Thanksgiving. So they said right before Thanksgiving, then it was crushed upon by hundreds of people checking into this hotels, coming and going. They said any of the potential witnesses in this area were completely gone by this time, because it was such, you know, you're talking about United Nations, you're talking about a hotel, hundreds of people, thousands of people coming and going and coming and going. It couldn't have been a worse time to lose somebody. Now, when I explain all that to you, does it not sound like a type of storm blowing in when people go missing?
Yeah.
This is a human storm, correct?
Yeah.
Makes me think of what's missing out in the woods. There's always a storm blows in that something happens. It's almost like whoever took Jesse or whatever happened to Jesse was waiting for these things to do. Now, here's what's wild. They even tracked down some hotel staff and even other students that they had seen on video maybe conversing with Jesse when they went back to watch it. They tracked them down and questioned them. Nothing changed. Nothing. Nothing. They said that everyone at the party had been drinking, but they said nobody had really at the time was paying attention to anything around them. So it's like, nothing. Nothing was going on. One of the investigators to this thing even was quoted saying this, that you have teenagers and young adults, you have alcohol and the freedom of being out of town or somewhere new. He says that in itself can be trouble right there in the making. That's what he said. So he believes that there is something going on there that's foul play. The problem is this. He never left that hotel. They can't find anywhere that he went. So it would tell me, and this is going to sound, of course, crazy. Before we wrap this puppy up, I'm going to tell you this, at least the way I feel about it is, in order to make someone disappear like that, you have to work at that hotel. And the reason I say it is this. How many times have you seen them wheeling laundry baskets, those big laundry carts,
yeah,
in and out with sheets and stuff?
All the time.
You see them loading stuff in and out of trucks, in and out of maybe the restaurant parts there at the back. Even guys that's got, you know, suitcases and luggage loaded on luggage racks. It's things you take for granted because you're like, oh, that's part of their business. It's none of my business. I'm on vacation. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. Easily, you could get them if you work there. You knew where the security cameras were. You knew where you wouldn't be seen.
Exactly.
You would be able to take. Now, why you would go after Jesse, I don't know. Maybe I can't find if he had anything going on, but maybe you got involved in the wrong thing at the wrong time. You get killed. They stuff you in one of those carts. They roll you up in one of those trucks, smuggle you completely off. That's the reason they can't find anything. There's no anything. There's no blood because there's none at the scene. And we all know that, of course, not cheap hotels, but good hotels are pretty good at cleaning. So I would assume that there's plenty of cleaning supplies, plenty of all that. So when he's gone, he's gone. They roll that cart up. He's no longer on the ground. He's no longer anything like that. It's not like they've hit him in a wall. No, he's gone.
That's crazy.
Vanished. Yeah. So it's one of those things, even just because you see the safety. And I always think back, my son's truck got broken into at the movies, you know, a while back. And there's video cameras out there. The bubble cameras, you know, that's up above the lights. They don't work at the movie theater out there.
They're just there.
Deterrent. They went down and they've never fixed them. They're just like, well, we didn't ever. Because I went in and talked to them. I was like, I need to see that footage right now. Oh, those don't work. They haven't worked in several years. I'm like, well, you, isn't that something? There's no reason. You don't have to have video cameras.
No.
They put them when they open. They don't have to keep them up. So it's a false sense of security. So when you see closed circuit cameras, things like that, don't take that for any sort of security measure whatsoever. These stories themselves is proven that people can be on video footage and vanish and nobody knows what happens to them.
Man, that's terrifying. Crazy. Well, let's take a break, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. You know, that's really eye-opening, and I'm glad you brought those stories forward today. And you're right about the security cameras, because I know that my wife, when she was younger, she worked for a couple different places at the mall, and she said that every one of them, that all the cameras were fake. And they're like, no, they're props. There's companies that sell these props that you put up there. They don't work. Not at all. So you're right. I mean, who knows? And what happened? I mean, I think, now that you got me thinking about this, I think when it comes to missing 411, these even adults, that there are people that are going missing constantly from all over all the time. I mean, I remember I was reading an article when I was preparing the story, A Place to Die, that episode, where I specifically read that, like, even on the Golden Gate Bridge, there's like 33 people a year jump off that thing. Mm-hmm. That's what they know of.
Mm-hmm.
How many people jump off, you know, and are never found, or off any bridge in any town?
Yeah.
It could be happening literally all the time. Or you go to Japan, the suicide forest.
Well, if you don't know that they're missing until it's too long, you don't even know where to start.
Exactly. Like, if you were to go and jump off that bridge and you didn't tell anybody, how would anybody even know? Mm-hmm. You'd be pulled out to, you know, out into the sea, and fish would eat you, and starfish and urchins and whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You'd just never be seen. So, like, but it makes me wonder when you were reading the story, especially the one with Dale. The one with Dale, where because the guy purposely looked at the security camera. Mm-hmm. He works there. He's a security guard. He knows where the camera is. He paused for a moment to look into it, and no one they don't know what that means. They don't know why he did it and where he went.
And where he went. They've still never found him.
Man.
Nothing. I mean, it's one of those things like you brought up with his family. It just doesn't sound like something a family man would go do. Now, look, I know he's divorced, but just because he's divorced doesn't mean he just doesn't care about his family completely anymore.
I don't buy, not for $100,000, you would not get up and just leave everything.
Yeah.
You know, even if you didn't really care for your family. I just don't believe that. All your friends, I mean, you're pretty much saying, I'm going to have to disappear from everyone I know for $100,000.
Yeah.
And that's if he owed, say, like you said, he might have owed somebody $40,000.
And that's in 1987. We're not talking about like in 1920. We're talking about 1987.
Right. So say you had to take 40 of it to pay back the guy you owed money. So now you're going to do all that for 60 grand?
60
grand. What are you going to buy, a Lincoln Navigator?
Yeah.
That's it. That's it.
Where are you going to go? Where are you going to expat to? You're going to have to go off into some other country and completely hide and never speak to your family.
Or friends.
Yeah.
Again?
Ever.
And I just don't buy that.
Yeah.
I don't buy it. I believe somehow, now, you know, because of course there's no audio on the closed circuit TV, but the guy in the mask might have given him a proposition that he couldn't turn down. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know, man. Very, very interesting. Also, speaking of interesting, I know several people have already asked about the McGregor Mayweather fight. It pretty much went the way I thought. Mm-hmm. I thought if Conor couldn't do anything the first four rounds, then it goes towards Mayweather heavily. And that's exactly what happened. It was a spectacle, man. It, to me, like we were talking in the building of this fight, how they looked like they were kind of buddy-buddy. After that fight, they looked like they were kind of buddy-buddy to me.
Yeah, they are.
And all that trash talking. If you really had hatred and disdain for somebody, you wouldn't be so chummy.
Yeah.
But I think they both just made an incredible amount of loot, so they're just like, yeah, yeah, good on you, bro.
Yeah, it's right?
Just like a heavy sparring session for me is all that happened, because he didn't look hurt.
No. Yeah.
He just looked like tired.
Yeah.
I mean, there was nothing. His eyes weren't swollen. Nothing. Just like I said, a heavy day of working out. I just made, you know, what, 150 large?
Yeah, once you go, when you do that and then compared to MMA, you're kind of like, you know but what, I think I like boxing better.
But that's the question, is like, now what? So now he went from making that in this fight. Now you're going to go back and fight in the UFC for what, $700,000? It's that really hard to do.
Yeah, he just...
But you know what I mean?
There's some renegotiation going to have to be done with him.
But he's not going to be able to get that kind of purse from fighting in the UFC. They don't have the money.
Yeah, they don't have that kind of money.
I think the highest fight ever paid was maybe the last Conor fight, or it was the Brock Lesnar, the last time Brock fought. I think
yeah,
that was
maybe,
only
I'm
like
not sure, but you're right. Yeah.
$2 million. You can't go from making 150 down to $2 million.
No.
Your girlfriend or wife ain't going to put up with that.
No, you're right. Yeah, you're 100% right.
Very interesting. Let's talk about our sponsors before we get out of here. Don't forget about Gaia. That's G-A-I-A. They are a video streaming service. They have all types of awesome episodes over there, especially False Flags with our man Richard Dolan. I like Secret Space. What up?
I've been doing a lot of the yoga stuff, no lie.
Have you really?
Yeah, I've been trying it, working on my stretching and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's over 7,000 titles over there, but you got to use the code, folks. That's GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. If you join now, your first month is only 99 cents, but you got to use our code GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. Also, book of the month, get your first book for only $10, but you got to use the code, folks. You got to go to bookofthemonth.com/expanded. That's bookofthemonth.com/expanded. If you have any news stories of your own or sightings or encounters or whatever you want to share with the show, please email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 817-945-3828. You can follow us on all forms of social media. Cam, what do you got planned for the rest of your week?
Man, oh man, you know what? I don't know. I'm just up in the air. I'm waiting to see how the whole thing, because it's always this first week of school here. So I'm always kind of just, you know, let's see how it all plays out, because it changes the town, you know, because it goes with the traffic changes. Everything gets haywire when school goes back. But the one thing that I did say is, like, if you ever want to go get some fast food around lunchtime now it's way easier in town to go eat anywhere around lunchtime.
I agree. Yeah, that's me. I'm just trying to get into the flow of things, getting the kids to go to school and get, you know, the homework and all that, getting back into the routine. That's about it. For all you Elite members, we'll be speaking to you on Friday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you again next Monday. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.